Welcome to Conspiranormal, everybody. It's your host, Adam Sane. I'm flying solo yet again, all by my lonesome. I have on the line someone that I'm really excited about getting on Conspiranormal and have been wanting to get this person on for a very long time, and that is Dr. Barry Taff. Dr. Taff is, well, I would say pretty much a legend in his field of parapsychology. One of the things you would probably best cases you would know Dr. Taff from is the Entity case, which we will speak about, but that was made into a movie, I believe, in the early 80s called The Entity, which I actually only got to see like just about a couple of months ago. But Dr. Taff, I want to welcome you on to Conspiranormal.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. I'm happy to be here.
Well, thank you for coming on. What I want to get into, first of all, is kind of like a brief introduction about yourself and how you came to study parapsychology and kind of what, you know, for people that may not know what parapsychology, what that term means.
Okay, well, let's define parapsychology in a way that hopefully everyone will understand. Parapsychology is a science that studies the way the exchange of energy and information between people and the environment in ways that preclude the five known senses. So you're acquiring information that isn't coming through normal mechanisms, or you're affecting the environment in a way that we can't explain. And that's what parapsychology is, somewhat of a misnomer because it's far beyond psychology, but they had to call it something, and that's where
right.
It is. What got me into this field was not simple curiosity. It was experience. I don't know about most other people, but I led a very strange young life. Ever since I was very young, I was having experiences that my friends and family were not. Telepathic, clairvoyant, precognitive, out of body. And I thought, well, everyone has these. Well, they may, but they don't talk about them. And so I'm a little different than other people. And what I've discovered over the last, I'm 66 now,
wow,
is that when people are really different, it's unique for a while, somewhat of a novelty. But if you're really different and it affects the way people perceive you, it's fun and games for a moment, and then they either want to you take advantage of who and what you are, or they are terrified of you and they want to run away and hide.
Yeah,
there should be no middle ground. So given that as a backdrop, I remember, let me think. When I was in, if you saw my family's album, my parents passed away some time ago, if you saw my family album, you'd be like, well, where's Barry? How come Barry's not anywhere? Well, the problem is I've always had a problem with being photographed. Doesn't
okay.
happen every time, but with such recurring regularity, especially when younger, that it was a joke. And to be more specific, I discussed this in my book and on my website, barrytaff.net. There was an instance when the lab was open. My colleague and I went to, it's called Television City in Los Angeles, there on the southeast corner of Fairfax and Beverly, and they shoot a lot of TV shows there.
Mm-hmm.
So we got a call in the lab. They wanted to interview us on the show. So we go, my colleague and I go down there, and we're talking to the people, and I was 74, I was 78, I was 29 or 30. And so they wouldn't take a picture of us, and my colleague at the time says, just out of the top of his head, well, Barry doesn't show up in pictures because he knew about my problem. And they went, yeah, right, he's a vampire. So I didn't say anything because I thought, you know, why is he making these comments? Anyway, they used a Polaroid SX-70. They take a picture of us. My colleague is standing about a foot to my right, right next to me. The film comes out. It develops outside of the camera, and you see him perfectly. Where I was standing, there's just light. No face, no hair, no body, nothing. Just light that conformed to my body. Now, it wasn't like this was, a piece of, if he brought a big xenon lamp in there, it would have obliterated myself and my colleague, not just me.
Yeah.
So what was this? And then going back further, in high school, your high school yearbook, you're graduating, you got to go have your picture taken. So I go and take a picture of me, and they said, well, there's a problem here. You didn't show up. What? Yeah, it looks like a cloud in it. It was all black and white, and Yeah, like a cloud. Like I wasn't even, no presence of me at all, just glowing light. Okay.
Okay.
It took three more times before they get one picture of me they could use. Now, you see, I've never liked the way I've been photographed. I just don't like the way I look on camera. Anyway, that's my problem.
Is this something in your studies that you've encountered with other people?
No. I mean, I know there are, I've read of many instances where people have problems either being photographed or taking pictures. And with me, it's in both direction because I remember about 20 years ago, I was taking a picture of my parents. I don't know, forgot what reason. My father had one of those throwaway 35-millimeter cameras. So I took a couple shots. The films developed, and in every frame I took, there were luminous anomalies. It
wow.
looked like glowing red, orange, yellow lights around them. But in the frames I didn't take, other people took, were normal.
Wow.
So, see, this is, you know, like, what's going on? There was an incident in 2009. I was speaking at Gettysburg, and this couple took my picture. This guy took a picture of me and his girlfriend, and you see her perfectly, and all you see where I am is a glowing cloud. It doesn't happen all the time, but it happens with, you know, it's just, there's so many instances of this throughout my life that it's one of the reasons I didn't get into photography. So what's the point?
Yeah.
If I keep doing this to film, what's the point?
Right.
It's a dead end. And so, you know, when these things happen. I mean, when I was younger, I used to be able to put my hand up to the picture tube of a TV, and you'd see brilliant color, like a coronal effect around my hand. Well, that's the effect a strong magnet would have up on this old picture tube.
Yeah.
I did it, and the next day the TV would be dead. It was just dead. So I didn't do that anymore because it was happening with such regularity. I wouldn't bore it. It's, again, why me? I don't know. These things happen. Let's go back. Let's see. In grammar, elementary school, you're 10 years old, you're in the fifth grade, and I've always been short, and I always have looked young. And when I was that young, I'm in grammar school, I looked like I belonged in kindergarten. I mean, it was a joke. So we're playing recess, you know, in the recess, whatever. I'm playing with some kids, I don't know. And this little blonde named Christine's walking towards me, and I'm looking at her, and she was a blue-eyed blonde, and I looked at her, and I said, I saw this strange image, like looking through her, she had a long dress on, a one piece. It was powder blue, and I went, what's that? On her right side, I saw a plastic bag and a tube going into her. I'm 10 years old. I didn't know what a colostomy was. How would I know what that is?
Right.
So I went up to her and I asked her about it. She freaked out and got the teacher. They dragged me in the principal's office. And he said, so what did you do? Did you sneak under in the girl's bathroom? Or did you look under her dress? I said, I did neither. I said, what do you mean neither? It just came on. He goes, what do you mean it came on? I said, you know, like Superman's X-ray vision. They went, what?
Huh?
So, you know, he's about to call my mother. You're in trouble, said Mr. You know, Barry. So I looked at him, and a big husky guy, thick brown hair, and wearing a dark blue suit. And I looked at him. I said, well, you've got that scar where your appendix was taken out. Now I call it a keloid because I know what it is. I didn't know that word back then.
Right.
And he turned purple on me as the scar looked. And it was amazing. So he freaked out because he did have a keloid there. He called my parents. He talked to my mom. My mom said, yeah, he can do it. And he says, what do you mean he can do it? He can do it. He can do it. Okay, so he hung up
with
my
mom. She was just blasé about it.
She didn't want to talk about it. She didn't want to discuss it at all. And so he said, okay, Barry, if this happens one more time here, we're going to expel you from school or we're going to have you arrested.
Wow.
No, obviously I've never had that. If I did have it happen, we don't remember. I never reported it, discussed it with anyone. So, you know, growing up with this, and then, I'm ever since I was a kid, I've been a medical intuitive. That word didn't exist when we were kids. I remember in junior high, there was this one girl in school named Helene, and she looked very normal. And whenever I got near her, even if I didn't know it, I would pass out. I mean, I'd be talking to a friend. She'd come up behind me, and she'd just, I'd block out. Oh, before I forget, one more thing about not being photographed strange. I found a picture of me in my parents' album. November 1964, I was 16, looks like I'm 10 or 8. And you see me in the backyard, and these weird colored lights are flying around me. No one saw it, but it was in the photograph.
Wow.
But anyway, so this girl, Helene, comes near me, and I kept blacking out. Turns out she's epileptic. And if I'm really close, standing too close to people who are epileptic, I start to black out. My body won't tolerate what their brain is doing. And it's so bad. I remember when The Dark Knight came out in 2008, I was at a screening at the Directors Guild Theater here in Hollywood. And I met her old friend there. I knew her from the UCLA days. So we drove separately. So we sit down. The film starts. And suddenly my bladder feels like it's going to explode, burning. Oh, God. Oh. And suddenly her phone rang. She had it on just vibrate. She had to leave because it hurt something to her daughter. So, you know, she didn't need my help, so she left. And the minute she left, I was fine. I found out the next day she had a bad bladder infection.
Wow.
The next time you tell me. So I've grown up with this, and it persists till today. I can make it work pretty much whenever I want, but I can't stop it from happening. Summers ago, one of my colleagues is a medical doctor. He grew up. I met him in the lab at UCLA. He was in town. He wanted me to meet his girlfriend and her kids. I didn't know their name. So they come over. It was warm. And he says, diagnose her son, okay, good-looking young boy, like 8 years old. And I saw the strangest thing I've ever seen in my life. Looking at him, it looked like the frontal lobes of his brain were missing. Instead of lobes in the brain, you know, of brain matter,
right?
It was just dark, like they were missing. And I looked, what the heck, I'm rubbing my eyes. What's so weird? He had cortical encephalopathy. Or encephalitis, meaning it's a disease that eats part of your brain away.
Okay.
But now my colleague knew it. His girlfriend, the mother of the guy, boy knew it. But I didn't know it. And then I looked at her. I swung my head over. Now, she's a young woman, like 42, stunning, really gorgeous brunette. I said to her, God, you must have smoked like a fiend. Your lungs are like old brown paper bags, a lot of dark spots on me. Do you have COPD? She freaked out. Her eyes jumped out of her head. She jumped up, grabbed her kids, and ran out of her like I shot her in the ass with a BB gun.
Wow.
So it's, you know, it's interesting to a point, but, you know, I'm writing a special edition of my book. It won't be out for some time. But I start out talking about what led me into the field, experiences like this. If you think being a closet Superman is fun, it isn't.
Right.
Because most people, if you have an ability that's not equally distributed in the population, which this is not, people oftentimes are frightened of you. They're worried. Or, you know, it's amazing. And when I finished my education in 1975, I got my doctorate, and I applied for jobs all over the damn country, everywhere. Not parapsychology, but as a, you know, in psychophysiology, biomedical engineering, blah, blah. And, you know, no.
That's what you had. That's what you got your doctorate.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So all these letters went out and no responses. And I said, well, you know, now today it's done with email, but there's no, you know, letters going out. So
right.
Weeks came by. Finally, a few got back to me and they said, you got a lot of nerve expecting us to hire you. I went, what? What are you talking about? Apparently, I'd been on the front page of the LA Times U section one day. That covers the world. And then I was in LA Times again in the big article, a little before that, with a well-known entertainment person. And then I was on ABC News for a week and other things. So by the time I got my doctorate, my future was pretty much determined. These universities were getting back to me. We could never hire you. Why? Well, you kind of strange, and you would intimidate, frighten, and distract other workers. You would intimidate them. You'd it would horrible, a very hostile work environment, a very hostile work environment. And I went, well, yeah, no, it's too dangerous. We could never. Okay. Now, early this year, I get some guy I've never heard get told of me. I forgot his name. He is a he's a physicist or an engineer or something. And he and some friends were allegedly setting up a new parapsychology lab, not at UCLA, but at UC Santa Barbara. They wanted to hire me, be on the board of directors, and help set up some of the research. And okay, great. So I sent them some stuff from my website, and suddenly the guy freaked out. I go, what's the? Well, look at this other work you've done. What do you mean? Didn't you look at the name of my book? He went, I didn't know you had a book. What? I said, where do you find me? On LinkedIn. But it references my background. We didn't look. All we saw was the doctorate, this, and then he saw the stuff on ghosts, the poltergeists and apparitions and hauntings and the UFOs, and he went, okay, no, we can't argue. Again, hostile work environment, too dangerous. You bring a real... I said, but you didn't bother to check me out before you contacted me? Apparently not.
Well, isn't parapsychology, I mean, I understand maybe it's not necessarily the study of ghosts and apparitions or UFOs.
Well, that's one part of it.
But you're still, as a parapsychologist, kind of thinking outside the box. So it kind of it surprises me that if he wants to set up a parapsychology lab, why would he freak out so badly?
Because they only wanted to do a couple things. No ghosts, no apparitions, no poltergeists, no UFOs. Yeah. They wanted to do precognition and then what turned out to be remote influence, which is psychokinesis. So, okay.
Okay.
So, but they, you know, they hadn't even read one thing I wrote on my website. Oh, they read one thing I put up on LinkedIn about the medical patents that my colleague and I have developed.
Right.
And that's it. But he didn't bother to look me up at all. And I said, are you people brain dead? The right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing? No, I said, wait, aren't you supposed to do your due diligence before you call me? Yeah. Okay, well, sorry. That was it. End of story.
Well, Dr. Taft, before we talk about kind of getting into the kind of the meat, which is like kind of the entity case and some other cases, there's a couple of terms, you know, to define here. And you talk about this a lot in your book. One is PK, psychokinesis, and RSPK, recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis. Can you kind of define what those are and maybe the differences and similarities between them?
Psychokinesis, not telekinesis. Telekinesis is an antiquated term. Psychokinesis means mind over matter. Psycho, mind, kinesis, move. Okay? Mind over matter. And the mechanism, whatever it is not based on anything electromagnetic we're aware of. Meaning the forces at work, they may be affected by localized electromagnetic fields, but they are not, in essence, electromagnetic. Okay. Then you have recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis. That is a term that more clinically defines poltergeist activity. Now, in psychokinesis, there are two types. One type is the type of, worked on in a lab, microscopic, affecting the computers in terms of affecting the randomization or, you know, programs. The other is affecting subatomic particles or affecting other types of matter. Random event generator, it used to be random number generators. Decades ago, we had something called the Schmidt box. It contained strontium-90 that could decay in one of four paths. Anyway, you could use it for psychokinesis or for precognition. Anyway, so there's two types. The microscopic is the stuff in the lab, the affecting random event generators, blah, blah, cloud chambers. Then you have the macroscopic type, which is what we encounter in hauntings and ghosts.
Right.
And the problem is, here's the problem. It's one thing to affect something a few inches or feet away in a subtle way. That's in itself pretty amazing. But when you do that, microscopic, people show fatigue and exhaustion when they do it. It's not like you just flex your arm and it happens. Okay, now the macroscopic, the stuff with poltergeist activity, spontaneous fires, banging noises, objects appearing and disappearing, objects being thrown around, people being thrown around, objects breaking, machines starting and stopping. Okay, here's the problem. Okay, that's macroscopic. There is no fatigue or exhaustion seen on part of the agents. The agents are people, living human people like all of us, but they seem to be a little different than other people in the respect that the majority of them seem to be hypersensitive to environmental electromagnetic fields. That could mean objects in your home. That could be the geomagnetic environment you live in that's beneath your house or the area. Secondly, the majority, if not most of them, tend to be either seizure-prone or epileptic. And what's interesting is this is a bilateral, it's a unilateral thing. The majority of people that I've worked on thousands of cases seem to be seizure-prone or epileptic. But most people who are seizure-prone or epileptic are not poltergeist agents. That means there's a missing unknown variable. That variable could be the person's inability to cope with stress. And, you know, everyone does that differently. Some people, no matter what happens, they're fine, they walk away. Other people, one little thing goes wrong and they fall apart emotionally. Yes. So this is what's going on. Now, we have all these instruments we take out, environments, and we can measure electric fields, magnetic fields. However, measuring a bioelectric field is really easy. We're measuring biomagnetic is almost impossible. It's very hard. You need very sensitive superconducting superconducting quantum interference device. The body's magnetic field is really, really low or weak in amplitude. However, among these unique poltergeist agents, their bodies are often putting out more than a million times the magnetic field of a normal person. In parapsychology, in any science, you try to conduct experiments. You form a theory, you have a hypothesis, you then test it under controlled laboratory conditions. Well, that's fine for telepathy or precognition or remote viewing or whatever, clairvoyance, fine. But when it comes to stuff that we can't control or manipulate through the variables, or modify the parameters, what we have to do then is collect data over a very long period of time and look to see if there's any longitudinal continuity in the data, meaning is there a pattern that we keep seeing? And just what I've said, yes, it's real, it's paranormal, but I'd say that 99.99999% of this is not from dead people. It's an extension of living human psyches. Like, I remember, we've been on so many cases. I remember at the Playboy Mansion 10 years ago for Girls Next Door. I never heard of the show, and the co-creator I ended up knowing. And he called me to go on the show. I said, okay, great. They paid me. Went to the house, and, you know, I don't know what existed there before, but, you know, it was nice meeting, Hugh Hefner and the girls that were there. And one of the girls, the phenomena seemed to be focused on her. And I put several of our magnetic detectors near her, and it went nuts. We were getting 5,000 milligauss. That's 5 gauss. Coming from a human body? No. The other people there who were not poltergeist agents, you didn't see the thing.
Yeah, it doesn't happen normally.
Right. You go, nothing. You took the same instruments, measured the other people, perfectly normal. Around one of the women, it went nuts. Gee, what a coincidence. Jeez. And we've seen this over and over again. Their body, all this huge surges in neurochemical activity, spiking and spindling, and their bodies are emitting these tremendous amounts of energy. And, you can measure them with normal instruments, but it's very rare for people to have this problem. The thing is, parapsychology is like, in a way, looking for answers is like the three blind men and the elephant. Okay, so one blind man is grasping its arms around the elephant's leg, and he thinks it's a tree. Wrong. It's not a tree. The other blind man is holding the elephant's trunk and thinks it's a hose. No. The third blind man is holding the elephant's tail, thinks it's a rope. All wrong. Why? Because they have limited situational awareness because they can't see the elephant. and therefore they don't know what they're perceiving. This is where we are today. We're measuring or studying the effects of an unknown cause. Now, in getting back to the more subtle stuff, see, it comes down to this. There's some evidence now, okay, that our memory, this is called the, implicate order. It suggests, and there's one, I won't use his name because he got in a lot of trouble for this. He was an MD and a PhD, spent more than 20 years documenting this at Caltech and other facilities. The evidence suggests that our memories, our own memories, long-term memories, are not stored in our own brain. Well, then where are they stored? In this external power field, which is called it's a power field, basically. And it's that we access them by linking up with that mechanism. This is amazing.
Our own internet in a way.
Right. The way we're designed, the way we're built. One of the blogs on my website is called Implicate Order by Design, meaning that if we are indeed designed to do these sort of things, that our memory is stored independent of our brain, that means whenever we remember things, as I'm doing now, what I'm speaking or not doing now, what it says basically implies that the way we remember things is accessing something through what might be called remote viewing. It's a power field that is not, the zero point field, zero point energy field. And it's the only thing that makes sense. So if the way we're designed is to access this on a daily basis, every day, and that's the way we remember to do everything, that means there is no paranormal. Paranormal is normal. We've been misled and misguided into thinking this stuff is not real. Not only is it real, but it's the way we may be designed to work. But see, this brings up another problem. This suggests that it's the information that made up the past. Not the people, the information still exists. It also means the information here and now, whether it's in the room you're in now, the room I'm in now, or miles away, or thousands of miles, or millions, is accessible. Or the information of the future, not the events. The information of the future already exists. And what we're doing with telepathy and clairvoyance and precognition, we're accessing this information remotely, non-localized information. And depending on where it comes from, in regard to where we are, we perceive it, will determine what we call it. It comes from the past, it's retrocognition. It comes from the future, it's precognition. Displaced in space, independent of a viewer, it's clairvoyance. Displaced in space, someone else's mind, that's telepathy. So it's all the same thing.
Right, we're actually dealing with the same thing, yeah.
Right.
It's how we perceive it that's different.
Right, exactly. And this may explain a good part of what makes us human, but it also gives rise to the possibility that we may have no more control over our future we have over our past. In other words, what if we discover in the end, all said and done, that the future's already there, where we're like water that we fill up the container we're in. We take the shape of that container. So what if the future is as immutable as the past? Then what? Then what do we do? You know, the old, there have been science fiction movies and shows done on this where, you know, someone, you say you know that your friend John Smith will be hit by a truck on the morning of January 1st, 2017. You don't tell him, it might freak him out. You invite him over for dinner, slip him a Mickey, you put him in the spare bedroom or a closet to avoid the accident. Well, what happens is he's in there, he doesn't wake up, what am I doing here? It's all dark, he doesn't know how he got there. Suddenly you think, well, he's not going to hit by a truck today, I've saved his life. What you didn't see was that a big truck jumped the curb, came into your house, and killed him because he was in the closet.
Yeah.
Or at Lynn. you know, this is, this is, it's, I mean, they've done Twilight Zones on episodes that dealt with this.
Yeah.
An old series, the late 50s, early 60s called One Step Beyond had these sort of things. An example, 1970 was my last year of undergraduate college. So I met a girl in the psych department named Sharon. The best way to describe her was she's a clone of the current Jane Krakowski, the actress. Exact same looks. I mean, exactly the same. They could be twins of each other, although I don't know how tall Jane is. Anyway, so we were dating, and not Jane, but this girl, Sharon, I knew in college. And everything was great. Got along really well, and then came the dreams. And the dreams, I'm in the back seat of a car. I didn't know it was my car because I couldn't see the dash, and all I saw was the back of someone's head driving, but I couldn't tell if it was me. However, I could see the passenger seat, and in the passenger seat was Sharon. So we're turning down the cul-de-sac to get to her house in the valley, San Fernando Valley, and suddenly a large, dark car flew out and hit us. Horrible impact, glass flying, bank smoke, the whole bit. And suddenly things clear, and I see her bloody and unconscious in the passenger seat. I went, oh, no. So I couldn't tell who was driving still. So I had the dream a couple times. I go, this is not good. So what I did was I told her about the dream, and she was upset with me, but not for the reasons I might suspect or expect. She was angry because she thought I was making the whole thing up with a lie because I didn't want to date her because she lived too far away. I go, hey, gas was 25 cents a gallon back then. Who cares?
Right,
you know?
Right.
And I had a good car and all that. Why? Anyway, so I said, look, it's not
even
worth
with
it.
Those big 70s gas guzzlers, right?
Yeah, I had at the time, I had two cars. I had a Z28 Camaro with the dual Hollies on a manifold from the factory and four-wheel disc brakes and the heavy-duty Ford. Anyway, everything. Then I had a Corvette, which I ended up turning into a race car. It was too hard to drive on the street, an L88 Corvette. Anyway, so we stopped dating, and she eventually started dating someone else. Like, hey, if she threw at me what I threw at her, I might have reacted in the same way. She's very skeptical. So weeks, months go by, to get a call from her mother. Yep, the accident occurred. The driver was killed instantly, and she was badly injured. I didn't change a damn thing. I misinterpreted what I saw. My ego put, I must have been in the driver's seat. No, I never saw me. I saw some guy with thick, dark hair, but it wasn't me.
Right.
So, okay, did I change it? Probably not. Let's go to 1975. So I'm with the girlfriend, and in the dream, I'm piloting a 747. It was TWA. We were on approach to South Africa. I have no idea how I knew that because, you know, those airlines don't fly high enough to see continental features, you know, divides.
Right.
So we're on the descent, and suddenly the drone of the turbofans go up, it disappears. It's a dead stick. We're going down. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And we crash in my dream. I jump up out of it, sweating bullets. And what's my girlfriend? What's wrong? I just crashed a 747. What? So they had just gone into service like the year before. Did some checking. Nope. So I couldn't call the FCC because I didn't know when or where. I just knew what. Was it a week? Is it a month? Is it a year? Is it 10 years? Is it just fantasy in my mind? Well, she told the girlfriend about it, Darlene, and the whole bit. And a few days later, the first 747 went down. It was a TWA, and it was on approach to South Africa.
You know, in that, and I just read that actually in your book like last night. It's interesting that particular dream because it's almost like, how did you know you were in South Africa? Well, it's almost like you were in the pilot's head or somewhere in the cockpit.
Right, exactly. Because if you're looking out of the cockpit of the airplane, the cabin, you can't tell where you're at by looking.
Right.
There, you know.
Exactly. Yeah.
If you were double the altitude or triple the altitude, yeah, because you see exactly where you were. But you can't. So that means, and also, how did I know the plane is TWA?
Yeah.
I don't know. I just knew it.
No? Right.
And then, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the role of epilepsy. I was going to kind of say this for a little bit later, but the role of epilepsy in PK, this is something that's fascinated me, and I've heard you speak about it before. I actually know someone that is suspected of having epilepsy, not quite certain that she actually does, but I can tell you that weird things surround this girl.
What type of things?
Well, she's had, there was a belief, it's actually been on my show, actually has talked about it, Ouija board experiences where the Ouija board has moved. I think that that's something that's kind of common for a lot of people.
Yeah.
She's heard auditory things, like she heard what she thought was her brother going to the bathroom,
right.
And she went upstairs and no one was there.
Right.
Certain just kind of those kind of precognition as well.
But what about physical phenomena? I mean, objects appearing or disappearing or moving or.
I don't know. She has told me that she has things had moved.
Okay.
But I can't remember specifically what moved.
See, what I do when I go down a case is I fill out a very lengthy form. They ask these people a lot of questions about their background, their health, their family health, what medications they're taking, whatever, what the general, their diet is. What their family history is. And what's odd is sometimes you ask about the epilepsy or seizures, and they go, no, no, no. You say, well, you have any sleep problems? And they go, what do you take? And woman said she took, I forgot the name of the medication. And it was Klonopin, which is an anticonvulsant. And I went, Klonopin? Yeah, she says, well, I get these spasms in my muscles, and it stops that, and I can sleep. I go, so that would be similar, because you're getting neurological spasms caused by problems in the brain.
Right.
So, and then if you don't ask the questions, don't take measurements, you're not going to learn anything. And so, it's not like this is happening occasionally. This is happening all the time. And my guess is, if you could do a very elaborate study, a lengthy one, and track people who went around the world visiting haunted locations, 99% of them, you go there, they read them and go there, nothing happens. Very small percentage go there, and stuff occurs while they're there. They have an encounter or an experience. If you do medical workups on them, you'd find they have a neurochemical imbalance. They have they're epileptic or they're seizure prone. And one guy called me years ago after I talked about this on our Bell show, and he said, it's odd you mentioned that, because I was having this stuff a lot or happen to me, and then I started taking the medication for my epilepsy, and it not only did the epilepsy stop, but the seizures, but the phenomena stopped.
Yeah.
Then he started taking the medication because he didn't like the way it made him feel. So the seizure started, and so did the phenomena. Now, this suggests that the same part of the brain may be responsible for both things, but it would cost a fortune to test it, and any doctor, any MD who got involved with this would very likely lose his license and would never be able to make a living again.
Right. Well, two cases that I want to ask you about, Dr. Taft, and that is, of course, the Entity case, which was made into the movie. I've only saw the movie, and just like a couple of months ago, that case and also the San Pedro case.
Right.
But about the Entity case is, what were some of the manifestations that were going on there?
Let me make some blanket statements up front. One is
the
Entity movie was based on a novel written by Frank DiFelitta. Okay,
right.
He did a great job. He was with us at Doris Blatter's house a long time, decades, 40 years ago, and witnessed things and interviewed her at length. So remember, it's a novel. I'd say at least 95% of that novel is fictitious. Yeah, I mean, it's
kind of like Amityville Horror.
The Amityville Horror was a hoax from day. There was nothing. But what I knew, people that investigated it, the academicians, they could verify nothing of what was in the book. Anyway, let's not waste your time talking about that. So the Entity case began in the summer of 1974. My colleague at the time, Kerry Gaynor, was talking to one of his friends in a bookstore in Westwood, Hunter's Books. It's one of the few accurate parts of the movie.
Yeah.
And
in the
aisle over, Doris Beither, with one of her friends, heard my colleague's conversation with his friend. And so she said, oh, by the way, my house is haunted. So Kerry said, give me your number, and we'll get a hold of name and number. So, we're now at Culver City 2 days later. It's on Braddock Drive. And the house is still there. Back then it was a broken down little shack in really bad condition. Been twice condemned by the city. Anyway, we go to meet her. She's got four children, each from a different husband, three boys and one young girl, a baby we never met. Okay. Small woman, a little bigger than me, dark hair and blue eyes. Very cryptic and evasive in her answers. And the very first thing she said to us was that she'd been repeatedly raped by a ghost and went, oh, God. The woman's out of her mind. You know, she's insane. Rolled her eyes back. I wrote a P on top of the form, which indicates psychosis, that, you know, you're wasting your time. Well, thank you for your time. That was it. About a week or 10 days later, she called back. Some neighbors had been over and a friend, and they had witnessed things happening. Okay, well, assuming they're not lying, that gives a little more objectivity to the case. So we go back. It was a hot August night. Neil Diamond wasn't there. And the house was really odd. The bedroom felt like a refrigerator, even though it wasn't air conditioned, nor was the house. Very hot and humid at the time, very muggy. So we're in the kitchen talking to Doris, and a lower cupboard door swings open, and a frying pan comes flying out across several feet and hits the floor. So we check for wires or kids or animals in there. No, no, or pets. No, no. So it escalated over time where we began to see these strange, what I call corpuscular masses of light. Not orbs. Orbs, what you hear about orbs, 99.999999% of orbs are absolute crap. You want to see orbs? Be in a real dark room. Take a really bright illumination source, like I have a keychain with four LEDs. You put it on, and you can see this particulate of dust. They are everywhere all the time. You flap your hands around, moving them, and you'll see all this motion. The only place you won't find those dust particulates are in clean rooms where they build satellites.
Yeah.
And you want to see them also. Take a laser, fire it away from you in a dark room. Little speckles within the laser light, those are dust particulates captured in the beam. No orbs and crap. What we saw.
You also deal with insects, too.
Right. Yeah. Right. What we saw were large, the size of several, two fists together. Large fists, and they were always lime green in color, zipping around the room. Now, in my book and on my website, I talk about this, and there are some pictures, and they are quite remarkable. One of the pictures, you see Doris is on a bed, and the walls behind her meet at a 90-degree angle. This is very important to remember and to take note of. Doris is framed by an arc of light. Now, we never saw that. What we did of seeing were these lights zipping around Doris. And we got an arc. So what we might have gotten was a time-lapse picture. Had we been shooting faster in terms of exposure time, it mean that stopped the light. We were shooting, fast enough, which Kodak Tri-X. We had to push it in development because the room was really dark. And behind Doris, the walls meet at a 90-degree angle. This is really important because if this light source was projected against the wall, like in the case of fraud, the arc of light would be bent in accordance with the wall, and it is not, which means the light is in free space. Now, what's paradoxical about this case, most of what we saw we couldn't photograph. Most of what we photographed we couldn't see. We see another frame where Doris isn't even in the frame, and these two arcs, there one's running top to top, the other bottom to bottom. We never saw that. So we gave the camera and the negatives to the West Coast editor of Popular Photography, a man by the name of Adrian Vance. He examined it. He wrote an article, the first ever, only ever, in Popular Photography. And he said, I have no idea what this is. He said 35-millimeter SLR cameras should not even be able to record something like this. He has no idea. Okay, wow. Now, the woman, we couldn't prove or disprove her claim of she was raped because she was no virgin, but we began to see more and more lights flying around the house, and at one point, we got a call from Doris at about 1:32 in the morning. We go running back down there in Culver City. Carrie lived in Brentwood, Westwood, and I lived right on the edge of Beverly Hills. Going back there, we go down there, and here's the thing. First picture we got of this luminous anomaly, it looks like a comet with a tail on it. We couldn't tell where it was coming from and going to. We had no reference. Where was it in the room? What direction did it face? So we covered the room in black poster boards with duct tape, and we made a checkerboard on her walls and ceiling. And each board had a number and a magnetic orientation, so you knew where you were shooting towards and where you were at the time. So we come back to Doris's place, and all the boards have been torn down with the duct tape, and the plaster and the paint is torn down with it. Now, she could have gotten on a step stool or a ladder and done it, but for the way she was reacting, I didn't think so. Now, and then another point the case went on, lights were zipping around. This was over the course of almost three months. At one point, the lights coalesced into a white wood in the bedroom. They merged and they formed a large apparition from about the waist up. It was not a static image. It was definitely dynamic in the sense that it was moving. You could see the head, the brow ridge, the shoulders, the pectorals, the upper arms, and it was like it was looking at us. And what the, we didn't capture this on film. We shot a lot of frames of film and nothing showed up. And but again, it was lime green in color. And it was huge, maybe 6 to 8 to 7 feet was huge. Okay, so what was that? We don't know. Now, you know, the suggestion is that maybe there was some electromagnetic energy in the house that was causing us to have hallucinations. Well, if that were the case, and of course we know that can, you know, from the work of Michael Persinger, that very low levels of electromagnetic energy can induce both visual and auditory hallucinations. Okay.
Yeah, this is his helmet. Yeah.
Right. But if you do that to, first of all of us would not have been affected in the same way because we're all a little different from each other. Even though we're the same, we're different. So you wouldn't have the continuity. People would see some things, others wouldn't see anything. Before we did, we said everyone to sit down and write down what you saw. Don't discuss it. Everyone described the same thing. So if there was such a mass form of hallucination, which you don't subscribe to that theory, it isn't supported here. If there was hallucinating going on, we would have had a very wide variety of what we saw, and that was not the case. So what did we see? Another time, the fuse box tore itself out of the wall and just missed Doris's head. We weren't there. And then candelabras were thrown at her. So eventually she moves from Culver City to Carson. We didn't bring her to the medium because she would have made a terrible witness for many reasons. So we finally found her, tracked her down with the help of Frank DeFelita. I had already met with her many times, taking notes. He was writing the novel. And in her new house, her neighbors knew nothing about her. She didn't talk about what was going on. Now, new things start happening in her new home, similar. So we're there, and this is in my book. We're holding a little seance, and suddenly a vase flies across the room, and it lands in the middle of everybody without hitting us. And then we hear we had a condenser mic on this small cassette recorder I was using to record audio. And we hear a voice, and we hear like hard breathing, and we hear feet dragging, like an old episode of The Mummy from Universal. And it approaches the condenser mic on my small recorder, and it shuts it off.
Okay.
And I don't know. Okay. So the woman, she moved again, either to San Bernardino or to Riverside County, and again and again. And last time, we didn't hear from her until the movie came out, which was in 83. You know that movie came out a long time ago, 32 years ago.
Yeah, 32 years ago.
And, you know, she liked it, and I didn't like it because they were supposed to hire Frank DeFelita to direct it. The last minute took it away from him, and they gave it to Sidney J. Fury. And he thought we were all nuts. He thought we were all out of our minds. And he rewrote a lot of the script, and I didn't like what he did. But hey, you know, once it goes out of your hands, that's it.
Yeah. And that's kind of Hollywood, though, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's, you know, there's a chance I'll be doing a remake, but it won't be a remake. The version, the movie I will be making will be a movie based on what is written up in my book and on my website. It will not be based on the novel or the original film, because that is fiction. What we're going to do is, it's a dramatic film, it's a drama, but it will incorporate, there was no, like in reality, there was no psychiatrist Doris was seeing. No.
Yeah.
That was part of the novel, and it worked. I mean, you know, what's interesting, when we were casting it, Barbara Hershey pleaded with Frank DiFilita and I forgot the producer's name or whatever. She wanted the lead role. She begged him, okay, as did Ron Silver. And then the movie comes out years later, and they all, the biggest mistake of their life, the biggest mistake of their life. What? Yeah. Oh, because the movie got lambasted in the media. They tore it apart as being misogynistic and being, you know, just terrible and whatever. And then Barbara, biggest mistake, I said, yeah, after she pleaded with everybody to be on it, she hates it. And then she ends up doing Insidious several years ago.
It's like, okay, yeah, that's her, yeah. Hey, right,
She's an actress, yeah. Right? And one of my friends was making a miniseries with one of the cable networks, the high-end cable network, the Showtime, or with her. And I told him that she didn't want to hear about this. So she comes and he's talking to her. He mentions my name in the entity, and she said to him, if you mention that man's name again in that movie, I'll walk off your film and you can sue me.
Wow.
And then Ron Silver hated it. And Frank DiFilita was in New York years ago before Ron Silver passed away. And he went up and said hello to him. Ron Silver said, I never want to talk to you. The biggest mistake of my life was to be in your film. Hey, you're the one that wanted to be in it, remember? So, you know, what do you do? Sounds
you
like
know, Dr. Taft, for the most part, I enjoyed the movie. I just like, but that, those last few scenes, really, with trying to freeze the ghost, I just was like, you lost me.
Well, see, here's the whole thing. Here's where this comes from, and it's pure science. Yeah. It's physics. When Frank DiFilita was writing the novel, he was talking to me, and I was filling things in. So all of our druthers, well, you know, in science, your job is to collect data. Well, okay, light is produced when electrons jump from higher or lower orbits in atoms. As they do when they're stimulated, they emit photons.
Right.
That's what light is. Okay.
Right.
Well, that's a mechanical process. So my theory is, if you slow down the mechanical process, you would stop the mechanism that's producing it. You may be able to see it, at least be able to examine it. So why not try to freeze the phenomena when you see it? What would happen?
Yeah.
Now, they have found ways to slow light down, different mediums, not with paranormal, you know, in various mediumistic things. And they're seeing odd things. The whole point, literally, it wasn't a pipe dream. It's science. You drop the temperature of the phenomena to near absolute zero. And if it isn't a chemical process, it will be frozen. It'll be stopped.
Yeah.
So it's pure science. Of course,
right.
That event will never happen because, one, there would never be money for that, and two, it would be extremely dangerous to have a person close to that from a supercooling
yeah.
because you turn them into a giant popsicle.
Yeah. You would instantly kill them.
Yeah, instantly.
Yeah.
Right.
Because if you're absolute zero, well, I mean, that's
well, yeah, you,
absolute
yeah, you
zero.
You crystallize the body, and you'd be the little crystals, and you'd break apart.
Yeah.
So what do you do, right? It was fun doing it. I mean, it was okay. And but I don't think, you know, on my site I have one of my blogs. It's called The Frozen Ghost. And it said, other than the title of one of Universal's many horror movies featuring Wolfman and Frankenstein, or just Frankenstein, for all we, what if you have all the means and the money to do it and the phenomena was there and you spray it with liquid helium, what would happen to it? You can't freeze light. Light has no rest mass. I mean, the light in itself has no rest mass, but other objects do because they have mass. And they move, they pick up more mass and whatever.
Right.
It's just sheer physics.
I have to ask you, too, about one of the aspects of the case, and that was the fact that she claimed that, believe she said that there was three ghosts.
Right.
One would hold her down. One would rape her.
Okay. Now,
and
this
she had three boys.
This is pure psychoanalysis. Okay.
Yeah.
She claimed that there were three entities. Two smaller ones would hold her down. And the one big one would rape her. Now, in reality, she had three male children. Two younger, smaller ones. One older, bigger one. And then she had a strange psychosexual relationship with her whole family. And each kid was from a different person, different man. And my suggestion is this is a pure Oedipal thing. It was an extension of her own libido that we were basically played out through psychokinesis. I don't believe for one second that a ghost, two soul ghosts held her down when one raped her. It's an extension of her. It's just like a tulpa. It's a her psyche manifested this. And she was a troubled lady. Now, she died, I think, more than a decade ago, like in the late 90s, I think. And she died pretty young at the age of 58 or 59, something like that, and of cardiopulmonary arrest. They never figured out why her body stopped working, but it did.
Was the apparition that you saw, do you think that may have been a manifestation from her?
Yeah, I mean, in the book I talk about this on my website, that this is a projection of her subconscious or unconscious, that she was a very sexually oriented lady, and she might have had some kind of strange psychosexual relationship with the three boys. And all I know is she was very cryptic and evasive whenever we tried to interview her. She was much more open about her life with Frank DiFelita because he was an older man, older than her at the time. We were younger than her. She never told us her age. She would not tell us her age, which is a little weird. Anyway, you know, she was abused by her family, and she was also disenfranchised by them or disinherited because she was still rambunctious, and she was like a wild lady. But see, it was a libidinous fantasy projected from her. It takes on new meaning, and obviously there were no cameras rolling to see, oh, was there something really there, or was this an extension of her own psyche, or is it all the same thing? We don't know. You can't prove it, you can't disprove it, but we can certainly, you know, there were enough witnesses that witnessed these lights and the apparition to lay, at least remove the possibility that's all on her own mind.
The San Pedro case was similar too, to the entity case, in the fact that you had a woman that had a small child.
Two children, actually.
Two children.
Yeah.
And there were some similar aspects to that. And someone actually in that case actually really did get physically hurt.
Yes.
And there's a picture of it.
The case began in 1988, actually, where a woman named Jackie Hernandez saw me on a show on ABC or NBC News. I don't know what it was. And then she finally had her friend call me, a girl named Susan. A few months later, she got the nerve to call me herself. We went down there in August of 1989 in San Pedro, very hot and humid, and living a little tiny bungalow in the back on 11th Street in San Pedro. So with Barry Conrad, it was Jeff Wheatcraft, an associate of Barry, the cameraman, and myself, and a few others. Long story short, we started seeing the place stunk, really had a strange odor, similar to the entity case, like decomposing organic matter. Secondly, it was very hot and humid. Thirdly, the woman was living at her wit's end. She almost had no money, two kids, and you know, apparitions were being seen. Weird stuff showed up in Barry Conrad's cameras, his video cameras, and Barry Conrad has been and still is a professional video cameraman. He's not some guy just runs out chasing ghosts. Made a very good living of you know, being a professional cameraman. So why it struck out against Jeff, see, the phenomenon kept growing and growing. Jackie, really nice lady, living, I mean, it's amazing she survived all this. She looked at Barry and she really liked him. Tall guy, dark hair, blue eyes, very friendly, affable, successful. I think she misinterpreted his help as it's a place you can go to. But she began to look at Jeff as an impediment, and Jeff didn't believe a word coming out of her mouth when we interviewed him, which is Jeff's just more skeptical. Long story short, for one of the first nights we were there, Jeff's up in the attic where we heard banging noises, and we couldn't find anything. And something violently pulled his camera out of his hands. And we found it broken in two parts, the body on one side, the lens on the other, and it wasn't damaged. It evolved weeks later into Jeff, someone trying to hang Jeff in the attic with a clothesline wrapped in a bowline knot around his neck, and was picking him up over a bolt in the rafter. Had another one of our friends who was working there, Gary Baim, had not been in front of Jeff when he went, oh, like that, very likely Jeff would have died. He would have been strangled by it.
Who took the picture at that
Gary
moment?
Gary Baim. Gary turned, and there were no lights on. The only way he could see was by firing. He never fired the camera, and he
fire
could
the
see
flash.
Jeff
yep.
being pulled up, and his he got a rope around his neck from the cluster clothesline.
Wow.
So
it's a creepy picture too. Yeah. It's very creepy.
Well, the case went on. It's in my book. Chapter 3 of my book is called Hazardous Haunting, and it's really relevant because Hazard is the maiden name of Jackie Hernandez, Jackie Hazard. And also, it was hazardous to both Jackie and to Barry and to Jeff. Now, what happened, the case is very complicated. At one point, Jackie's going to Barry's house, and he lived in an apartment in Studio City in North Hollywood. Oh, yeah, Studio City. And Jackie would show up and leave, and she, Barry would give her cameras to take pictures with because she didn't have any cameras. And after she left, phenomena kept breaking out of Barry's apartment. I mean, this is in my book and in Barry's video. Question is, why? Why? Well, the reason it started attacking Jeff was, I read about this in my book and on my website, Jackie began to seriously dislike Jeff because she was really interested in getting closer to Barry, and she viewed Jeff as an impediment, as a barrier to get closer to Barry Conrad. Now, what we did know at the time is she occasionally went to Barry Conrad's house in his apartment in Studio City, and she stayed there a few times, and Barry and her got involved, and who cares? I mean, she's divorced, and he's single, right? Whatever they want. They're adults. But then he played games with her. He would throw her out while inviting another girl in, then throw the other girl out and invite Jackie back, and Jackie was getting more and more angry. So what we're seeing with the attacks, the psychokinetic manifestation in Barry's apartments, and the attacks on Jeff, to see the psychokinetic manifestations of Jackie's anger.
It's like an extension of her psychosis in a way.
Well, no, don't call it psychosis.
Okay.
If we knew then what we knew now about the epilepsy or whatever, it would be great to run her up in some studies, but almost 30 years ago, no one thought like this yet. But it was amazing because, again, we were doing a show for Hard Copy. So Barry was out shooting somewhere else in the country. It was myself and it was Jackie. And I said to the producer of this episode, who was there, a woman, let me ask Jackie a question. Okay, that's Jackie. What do you think of Jeff? She goes, I don't like him. Why? Well, he's always getting in the way between Barry and me. So I said on camera, they edited out of the show, this is what I'm talking about. This case is an extension of Jackie's subconscious. The woman went, what? Huh?
Yeah.
I don't get this. I mean, and then, okay, she lives in San Pedro. She moves. The phenomenon moves with her. Okay. But then new people move into San Pedro who knew nothing about her or the case because Barry hadn't produced anything yet, nor had we been on TV yet with anything. And new people moving in the original bungalow, they start having activities similar to Jackie's. They move out. So this suggests there's something unique about that environment that charged up to Jackie. Like, when you're healthy, you go to your friend's house. They got a couple of kids. You go in and you hang out with your friends. Even though you're not near the kids, you come home and you get sick, you give it to your wife. We know what that is. That's called contagious vector pathogen. Okay, we know what that is. Well, there isn't any vector pathogen here, but there's energy that's similar. She was living there. It irradiated her. She imbibed it or absorbed it. It altered her in a way we don't yet understand. She moved and kept emitting it long after she was gone. But meanwhile, new susceptible people came into the like Jackie were. Some were susceptible. Their body absorbed it and they began re-emitting it. And this is in my book. I call such people biological operational amplifiers, waveguides, and focal planes. I mean, it's unbelievable. You keep seeing the same thing over and over, over and over. Now, if I could go back 46 years ago and tell my young self what we know now, that my young self would go, you're nuts. Because no one thought like this. No one thought like this.
Right.
No one did. Because we just didn't know any better. Now, the problem is that these shows, You know, I think people really want to know what's going on. And most of these shows, they lie and they fabricate things. That's why I called it it's paranormal unreality shows. I just, you know, I've had it with this crap. It's ridiculous.
Well, you know, there was a paranormal witness show that on Sci-Fi that dealt with this.
And, you know, guess what happened? They approached me to be on the show. So they sent me a contract that says a small amount of money, which is okay. It said they might accidentally or intentionally do things to humiliate, embarrass, libel, and slander me. And if I sign the contract, I am not allowed to speak of it to anyone, nor am I allowed to comment in the media or to friends about what they've done. I went, what? Huh? I said, are you people out of your mind? I said, okay. They wanted to offer me $750 for my appearance on the show, which is, I guess, adequate. I don't know. But I said, okay, here's how it works. You want me to sign this contract? Add four zeros. That'd be $7,500. That'd be $75,000. That'd be $750,000. That'd be $7.5 million. Write it up as damages. I'll do your show. They won't do it. I said, you people are nuts. So I wrote some stuff online and about it on my website. And a couple of weeks ago, this producer who knows the producers from Raw TV that did that show, the show's been canceled, thank God. And, you know, and I just, apparently, what this guy said to me online, email, was that I've done a lot of damage in the writing I've been doing about these shows. I've really hurt them. Well, that's what happens when you tell a lie. You don't tell the truth. And they don't care. So apparently, this guy wanted to hire me for some new thing, and he wanted to use me to raise money, but he wasn't going to give me any money because if I helped him to raise it. And he said, well, he wanted me to sign his disclosure, non-disclosure, so I could never again speak about his friends or what they're doing, ever.
So before we move on, kind of, because I want to hit the alien stuff, I want to hit the alien abduction stuff, but I want to, so you would pretty much say that these shows, all these reality shows that are on, the ghost hunting shows, you'd say that they would probably do more harm to the field than they do good.
What they're doing is, first of all, they're crying wolf too many times. I can tell you this. I've been doing this work for 46 years. You have a much greater chance of being hit with an asteroid in the next 5 seconds than you do of encountering a ghost when you go out to find it. Or half of it. You're just not going to. And remember, let's say you're a producer, an executive producer of one of these paranormal reality shows. You have a real logistics problem. You cannot, it's an hour show, you can't have talking heads for 41 minutes and 32 seconds out of an hour, or your ratings will be as remote as your chance of capturing a ghost on video is. So that means you've got to do one of several things. One is you fake things. Two is you exaggerate and embellish whatever might occur. And the last is you populate the show with a lot of crazy people who are more interesting than if there were ghosts on the show.
You also can edit it to seem like more exciting than
that's what I'm saying.
Is.
You embellish and exaggerate whatever's going on. And, you know, it's interesting. My only paranormal reality show I've been on twice now is Zach Bagans' Ghost Adventures. And everyone asks me why I worked on with him several times now. Well, he's the only producer and host of his own show who has not asked me to lie about the case involved or myself or my work. That's a big order because everyone wants me to lie. Or I say things and they edit in a way where I'm saying something different. Zach wanted me to tell the truth, and I did. You know, Zach was very nice about it, nice guy. I got along really well. I'm not on the show to judge him or what he does, but I'll tell you one thing. You know, we've become sort of friends because I respect what he's doing, and he's also like me. He's a gearhead. He's really into cars, which is great. But also, he never asked me to lie, and so far, he's the only one who's been willing to do that. The only one. Before the genre began 11 years ago, I was approached by a producer. I won't use his name because I don't want to promote him. Never heard of the guy. He had an office here in Los Angeles, so I meet him. We're doing the show. Okay, well, let me ask you this, sir. What's going to happen? What do you mean? Well, I said. Nothing's going to happen. Oh, yeah, we'll fake it most of the time. And then when something does happen, we'll make it look like a hoax. I said, well, it was nice knowing you. Walked out the door.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. So it's just crap.
Well, you've increased my respect for Zach Bagans just a little bit here. So that's good that he's not asking anybody to lie.
One other thing I want to mention. I've come up with a term for describing the paranormal reality genre. It's the acronym is it's called Entertainment for the Ignorant Masses. If you make an acronym out of that, it's entertainment. It's EFM.
Gotcha.
EFM. And that's what I think of them.
Well, in your book, Dr. Taff, of course, it's called Aliens Above, Ghosts Below. And you do talk about UFOs, and one of the chapters you have is specifically on alien abductions. This is something we've talked about a lot on this show. Mm-hmm. And I've had you've mentioned David Jacobs in mm-hmm. in your book as well. Right. I've had Jacobs on the show, actually. Very interesting interview, very interesting mm-hmm. guy. But I want to – you have some kind of personal experience. Now, you don't have any, like, abduction experiences yourself, but there were others who were around you.
No, I've investigated some abduction cases. And the ones I investigated had, you know, some men, some women. And one of them got very personal because it was a girl I was involved with 38 years ago. Long and short of it is Valentine's Day, 1977. Okay. I went out in the case with my colleague here in West Hollywood. Never didn't know the people, walked in the door, and I saw a girl who, to me, was the most beautiful woman I'd ever laid eyes on. She, like, if I was going to design someone genetically for me, this was it. She looked, there was a long dead actress, not, she's long dead now, but in 1977, she died in 70, the actress's name was Mary Blanchard. And this girl I met named Judy looked exactly like Mary Blanchard. I mean, exactly. A clone. And, you know, so we became friends, kept talking, started dating. And, you know, she was, a lot of weird things are happening around her. Balls of light coming off her, poltergeist activity in her apartment, you know, but subtle. And, you know, so she attended our research groups at UCLA, and it was great. I mean, we were compatible in every way. But then came the dreams. And in the dreams, all I had, I kept having them about a month after we met. All I knew was on July 22nd of that year, our relationship would end. I didn't know why. I just knew what. So I tried to forget it. I didn't dare tell her because she might misinterpret it as a way to get out of the relationship, which I did not want to do. So I forgot about it, but I wrote it down. And the dreams are always the same. No information other than what occurred. So July 22nd rolls around, and I just slightly forgot about it. So, you know, we wake up, she's under the covers, and she's crying. She won't come out. What's the matter? She said, why didn't you help me? I go, help you with what? When the room lit up. I go, what? What room? What lit up? What? What are you talking about? The room. What are you talking about? I remember, I met her because there were poltergeist activity around her. And she says, well, under the covers, the room lit up. She found herself being picked up out of the bed like floating. And then she found herself inside a round metal room. And she was restrained on a metal pedestal-like table, like metal, some kind of bright metal. And she was restrained in her ankles, her wrists, her abdomen, and her neck. And these little guys around her, their skin looked reptilian, and she is terrified of snakes, big black eyes, the classic grays. No nose, no outer ears, no mouth, but she could hear them talking. They weren't going to hurt her, blah, blah, blah. And she was freaking out. They're cutting and probing. And so I said to her, she's under the cover still, do you know anything about UFO abduction? She goes, what? She knew nothing. Had no interest in the subject at all. No. Okay, so an hour and a half later, I finally coaxed her off from under the covers. I was amazed. Now, remember, I was around her for several months, a lot. So she didn't seem crazy or disturbed or psychotic or... Okay, she comes out, she had black hair, white skin, and dark brown eyes. Around her ankles, her wrists, her neck, and her abdomen were black and blue bruises. Her hair didn't cut. She was bleeding from her ears, her nose, her rectum, her uterus, and she wasn't menstruating, the edge of her eye. And there it looked like someone had taken a little melon ball and taken skin out of her back. And went, oh my God. So I asked her about UFO. She had no interest. Okay. So some neighbors a few. We didn't tell anyone what happened because, you know, how we know what she didn't know. She thought she didn't know what to think. Some neighbors said around where she lived in Hollywood, they said, "Did you see that thing last night?" I go, "What thing?" "It was hovering right over there." I go, "No, about 3, 2, 3 in the morning. Big glowing object like reddish orange hovering, and the power went out in her place for a little more than 2 hours. We didn't know what that was about. And they saw it. Okay, so can I prove it? No. Can I disprove it? No. If I had to make a bet, I'll say she was abducted. But I was laying next to her in the bed, and nothing happened to me. But again, I wouldn't take me. If I were there, I wouldn't take me. And I mean, as silly as that sounds, I suspect that one of the ways they manipulate us is through fear and intimidation. I mean, just be silly for a moment. This isn't that silly, because I had to live through it with this woman. They would say, "Hey, no, this guy wants to know our propulsion technology, our avionics, and our guidance. We don't need this guy in lecture. No, we can't do it."
Right.
But, so whatever. Now, I've been in touch with a woman a few times over the years. She became a religious zealot, but not a normal type of a really strange, almost cult-like group, but not the ones most people are aware of. I don't want to promote it by even giving a name to it. And she claims to have been re-abducted over. You know, she did get married to some guy, and she claims to have been re-abducted over and over. Well, you know, who knows? She might have been abducted before I ever knew her. So that now, had this relationship ended, had it not ended, excuse me, we would have been married within a year, and my life would have changed in ways I can't even imagine.
Wow.
But, you know, so that was, why did you ever get married? Well, my fiance was abducted. What? Huh?
You know, one interesting thing that I've encountered, and you write about it in your book, is the existence of this PK phenomenon, this poltergeist phenomenon, in conjunction with these people that are being abducted by aliens.
Right. It's
are experiencing alien abduction.
Paranormal fallout, yeah. Where they have abductions, and afterwards paranormal phenomena start happening, yeah. Others have written about it a long time ago. The late D. Scott Rogo wrote about it. Jacques Fallis has written about it. I've written about it now. And we don't understand. The only thing that makes sense is whatever UFOs are, wherever they're from, they'd be using energy that we call paranormal the same way we use electromagnetism.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know. I don't know. It's at another case, I think. Oh, one was, I can't give the name of a person, he's retired, but he was a TV network executive. And I met him because of a poltergeist case, ongoing things. He and his wife, very nice people, and, you know, married for a long time. They didn't have any kids. They lived way out in the valley somewhere. And started with, you know, PK, poltergeist activity, and evolved then into, they were taking a trip up north driving. And they saw what they thought was a plane about to crash behind the hills by the highway. So they drove around into the canyon, and they turned a corner, and there on the ground was a large disc. And these little humanoids outside of the disc picking things up off the ground, and they freaked out. Oh, my God. And suddenly the beings were aware of them. They aimed some kind of a tube with a light in it. They black out. They suddenly find themselves driving on the freeway many miles away hours later.
The missing time aspect.
Right. Yeah. And their marriage collapsed. This guy couldn't hold a job. They became bitter and angry and very unstable. And, you know, so, you know, it's odd. It began as a paranormal thing, or an RSPK thing, and it turned into an abduction. And we have other cases like this. It gets too weird. And why does this happen? We don't know. So does having one thing make you prone to the other? We don't know.
It's very interesting. You know, I spoke to, and I believe you may know this person, Stephen LaChance.
Yeah, I know.
He's written a couple of books about his experiences with a really seriously violent haunting that he experienced. And one of the things he talks about in that is he actually has a UFO encounter in the book.
Yeah.
Bill Bean is another person that I can think of that has had the same, violent haunting as a child.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, he was having the same kind of experiences. One of the things we've looked at on this show has been some of the ways of, and you mentioned Dr. Persinger.
Mm-hmm.
And Persinger, in his experiments, puts that electromagnetic helmet onto these people's heads, his students' heads, and they will actually see these little gray figures, as well as people that have taken the drug ayahuasca, which,
mm-hmm.
as I found out that you actually worked on the film Altered States, so
mm-hmm.
I'm sure you know, ayahuasca, people have the same experiences. They'll see these same beings and these reptilians, like the woman that you knew, what she experienced.
Right.
Is there a role with altered states of consciousness in this phenomenon?
Well, see, here's the most important thing. Because we can artificially recreate a hallucinatory state in our mind with a hallucinogen or electromagnetism, doesn't mean that a real event related to such is untrue. It's like, because we could make movies about going to the moon or whatever, there are people who have been saying for years now that the whole moon thing was a scam and it was done in a studio in Hollywood. But see, again, you can't, it's really bad logic to infer that because we can fake something or because it can be simulated through normal means, that the real event did not occur. That's faulty logic. It doesn't work.
Actually, I'm kind of coming from it from a different angle,
mm-hmm.
in that I don't believe that it's just simply a hallucination. I believe that there is an intelligence that's being communicated with, but through the altered state, it's communicating with us.
Well, we do know that, there are altered states of consciousness that, like when we were doing these psi training group, ESP training groups at UCLA decades ago, and we first, in order to get it to work, we would lull people into an altered state through progressive muscular relaxation and, the whole controlled breathing. And in that state, you're more prone to access because your mind is a tabula rasa. You're not dealing with your body in that moment. You're just waiting for images to form on that screen in front of your eyes or mind. And that's one of the reasons the Gonfeld experiments have worked so well. In terms of eliciting a psi in a controlled environment. Altered states of consciousness is very relevant here. And the problem is that sometimes people get carried away with it and they lose their sense of reality where they believe. In other words, if you start paying more attention to what's going on in your head as opposed to what's going on around you, you become a vegetable. That's called psychosis.
Right.
That's dissociative
right.
behavior. I've seen this happen all too often where there was a guy who, one of the psychiatrists at the NPI, and he came to our group a few times and kind of freaked him out. And then he went to Egypt and they snuck in the pyramid and he came out yelling they were demons and their entities, and then he ended up killing himself. Another guy, one of our regulars in our psi training group at UCLA back in the 70s, he's a writer. And he seemed pretty normal to me. He was very calm and whatever. Long story short, he starts working there, and he ends up, having precognitive visions of different people he knows die, and they weren't sick. They were killed in accidents, then his sister and then his mother. And then it turned out that he ended up committing suicide. It's opening one's mind could be a good thing, but also could be a bad thing.
Yeah.
You just can't control what comes in when, and it's very unsettling to some people because it's like a blind person seeing for the first time. Oh my God, look at this!
And I know you worked on that film, and you did explain to me before that some of that what you had written probably wasn't used, but I wasn't aware until about 3 years ago that Altered States was actually based on a real case, Dr. Lilly.
Right.
I believe he was taking ketamine.
Right.
Was what he was taking.
I mean, generically based, The whole thing is, this is the biggest problem with all of this investigating the paranormal. Because our minds are so supple and be influenced by so many different variables in and around us,
It's
hard to really control what's going on if you don't know what you're doing. And, for example, on my website, and I think on my book, I mentioned a little bit that we may have reached the stage where we might be able to reverse engineer the phenomena of poltergeists. instead of laying around scratching your head hoping for something to happen on a case, you manipulate the electromagnetic environment and you drive the phenomena the way researchers like neurophysiologists drive your brain waves with a photic strobe, meaning a strobe flashing lights in front of your closed eyes. It will drive your brain waves. Well, we want to do more than that. We want to drive the phenomena. Well, you might be able to do it, but you might end up electrocuting the person because it would fry their nervous system. So what good is it?
I do find it intriguing that if we can unlock some of this stuff, just the amount of power that we may be able to reveal.
And also, along those lines, this is what's even more interesting. I got a feeling that once we understand what's behind the PK, the RSPK stuff, and I think we're looking at a new form of energy. It is not like there's only four types of energies that we know of. There's electromagnetic, there's strong, weak nuclear, and there's gravity. That's basically it. We don't know anything
else. Right.
Yet
right.
The energies we're talking about here in these dramatic cases, in poltergeist activity, and like with Jeff being picked up, thrown on the wall like a rag doll in San Pedro, mentioned, shown in Barry's video, discussed in his book and in my book. Before that would happen, by the energies we know of, before he'd be lifted up free of a physical mechanism, everything in the room, including his clothes, would burst into flame by the liberated heat during the work done. Well, then, what? So the room also gets cold before the event. It doesn't get hot, which indicates that we're looking at a form of endothermic energy. Doesn't emit energy. It absorbs it, or it's another form of energy. And I have this gut feeling that if we ever discover what this is, this can send us to the stars. We could help power starships with this. I discussed this on my website in my book.
Yeah, it's like the concept of zero point energy.
Right, exactly.
And you mentioned that in the Entity case, right, that the room that was constantly cold, even though it was the middle of the summer.
Right. There's no source, so. It's the more we learn, the stranger it gets. That's the problem.
Right. Yeah. That is true.
Another way of describing it would be, one second. Let's say you're on a lake, and you're suddenly seeing a wake being produced in the water, but you can't see the ship making the wake. That's where we are. Oh, look at the lake. Where's the water? Where's the boat? There's no boat, but what's making? That's it. That's all you can do. We're measuring the effects of an unknown cause. And I think in the end, what we're going to discover about all this, we're not going to like it. It's going to make us aware of things existing around us we have no more control over than we do over the date we're born and the date we die. And I think it's going to be unpleasant, because it's going to describe and depict a reality where we're in some ways more responsible and in some ways less. So it may.
But that always seems the double-edged sword, right, of technology.
You get one thing, you lose others. There's no good way, there's no bad, it just is. So, I've lived a really interesting life, but at the same time, you scare a lot of people, they think you're nuts, and they run away from you.
Yeah. But I think lately that people are running towards this kind of stuff.
In academia or in the academic world, no. And in the financial world, no. Give an example. Several years ago, we submitted my business plan to do with my medical devices, which have nothing to do with parapsychology, to a major multinational electronics firm whose name I won't mention. Long and short of it, the executive vice president of development read our plan, was very impressed, wrote up a splendid overview and review, and passed it upstairs that they should initiate simultaneous development on three of our five devices. Great. So months go by, no word. So finally I make some inquiries. The head of the company calls me regretfully, and he starts saying, yes, business plan was crap, there's no evidence you've done any clinical work. And he said, you couldn't interpret the patents. I go, what are you talking about? Are you out of your mind? And they said, sir, stop. Tell me the truth. Stop lying. It was a long pause. Are you there? Yeah. I said, okay, tell me the truth. Stop lying. Okay, I'll tell you the truth. I never read it. I looked you up. The minute I looked you up, I knew it was crap. Ghosts, aliens, poltergeists, ESP, you're nuts. Boom, gone.
I think that's so unfortunate. I really do.
Now, if it, if I become, let's say I become some sort of celebrity, but made a bunch of movies and made a fortune, well, then they don't care if you're nuts. You've done something that's made a lot of people money. That's all
right.
they care about.
Unless you have the name behind you.
Yeah, but yeah. as long as you're, you know, people think you're nuts. And so couldn't get a regular job after graduate school because people, and that was 50, that was 40 years ago. Because
yeah.
they think you're nuts. You know, so it's a, I have to tell people if they're willing to get into this, spend a lot of time, they get a lot of media attention, they might not get much work because people think they're crazy.
Right. And I believe that may be a reason why some people that are coming up in this field now maybe are just not even pursuing an academic career.
Right, because they know they'll end up nowhere.
Yeah.
You know, no one will get near them. And these shows are doing a tremendous disservice to the field of parapsychology because they're making they're disinforming the audience into believing that what they're seeing is real when it isn't real.
Yeah. And it's becoming an aspect of popular culture, which academics kind of shies away from as
right.
well.
Exactly. But, you know, like I said, when I mentioned that thing at UC Santa Barbara earlier this year, it was very strange. But I said to the guy, didn't you bother to check the title of my book? No. Didn't you read any of my website? No. And I said, you're the one setting this thing up? I said, since they've got the wrong person. I mean, like, they're idiots. It's just like, now see, if they had hired me, gave me a contract, and then they fired me, I got to sue them because I would have lost money.
Right.
So he said, oh, no, we can't deal with this stuff. Oh, no, people will disrespect what you're doing. But it didn't disrespect what you're doing, did it?
Well, Dr. Taff, you know, we're kind of running out of time, but I wanted to... Well, I wanted also to throw something to you as
yeah.
well. You know, we mentioned about UFOs and
yeah.
and the Psi mm-hmm. connection there. And yesterday, in fact, I watched from the early 70s an episode of The Amazing Kreskin.
Oh, yeah.
And he had J. Allen Hynek on. And Hynek had actually, I think by that point, had come to the conclusion that there was a lot of connections with the paranormal and
right,
psychokinesis
right.
with UFOs as well.
Yeah.
So I found that interesting.
Yeah, it's yeah. The more we learn, the stranger it gets.
Yeah, it's true. It's very true, and I've definitely experienced that from doing this show, and we're speaking to a lot of people in various different fields.
Right.
But I wanted you to tell us about what you're working on now with future book projects, and also I believe you have a podcast that you're going to be starting called the
right.
Sci-Files Project
right.
Podcast.
Right. Well, let's see. My new book is called, again, it's a special edition of my first book. It'll have twice as many chapters. It'll have a lot more details about what's been going on, about what led me into this, what got me here, and the good, the bad, and the ugly. It'll be far more comprehensive. A lot of my lengthy blogs on my website that are not in my book, first book, will be in this one. So it'll be a much more comprehensive and detailed discussion of what I've been doing. As far as what I'm doing now, I already recorded two podcasts that are being edited. We're going to do more probably later this month, and then more from there as depending on how things go. And then... as I said, I will be one of the executive producers and writers on another Entity film, but it is not. We're not doing a remake because the film was based in a novel which was fictional. This version
right.
will have almost nothing to do with the novel. Will be based entirely on Chapter 2 of my book. So
excellent.
That
Very
will be
cool.
Along. So, you know, other things, some graphic novels in development based on certain chapters of my book. Well, you know, and that'll lead to other things. And so there's a whole bunch. But so far, we haven't been greenlit on the movie yet. We're actually going through some of the preliminaries of that, finishing development. And but we'll have a lot of interest in it. And I definitely don't want to have a cameo in the film, that's for sure. When we were shooting The Entity in 81, it would have been interesting, but now I have no interest in going in front of the camera. No, thank you.
What character was supposed to have been you in the Entity film?
Okay, they were the short guy with the dark hair and glasses.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, in the first Poltergeist film, one of the characters in there was supposed to be me as well. Remember, there was a black guy. That obviously wasn't me. Then there was the other guy with the real ruddy complexion. Something bites him in the side, and his face falls apart in the mirror.
Yeah, tears his face off.
That was supposed to be me.
Okay.
We were shooting the entity on the same lot as Poltergeist across a narrow walkway. They were seeing our dailies, and they rewrote the film. And from what I remember, was told by the executive producer, they shot a rape sequence with Jo Beth Williams, and they rewrote the film to make it look more like the entity. And they were told, not by me, that if that scene is in the film, they're going to be sued because then it would be the entity. And they shot it, but they cut it out.
Wow. So, interesting. This is little tidbits.
Tidbits of insanity.
Well, Dr. Taft, thank you so much for being on Conspiranormal. It's been very enlightening, and I've really enjoyed it. I'm going to close out this segment, but stay on the line with me just real quick, and I will be right back to close out on Conspiranormal.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to Conspiranormal. Of course, it's me, your wonderful host, Adam Sane. Once again, Lucas, and Rob is going to be going to work his festivals, and so he won't be back for another month or so. But a very interesting interview with Dr. Barry Taff. I thoroughly enjoyed it. The man is, like I said, pretty much a legend in his field. I've known about Dr. Taff for a good long time. I think originally the first heard of him on Coast to Coast. He's always a guest that I've always wanted to get on. So this was a real privilege and a real treat to get to speak to the guy and pick his brain. Once again, someone that has studied parapsychology, studied ghosts, but also at the same time has studied the realms of alien abduction, of UFOs, and someone that goes through a bunch of fields in the same paranormal realm. Not going to keep everybody too long. Like I said, really not much witty banter to do when you're by yourself, but so sad for me. But I just want to thank everybody for listening to the show. Please send us some comments. We would love it. We got a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/conspiranormal. You have conspiranormal@gmail.com is another way to reach me. And, I'd love to get some feedback and to correspond with everybody. Ways to listen, download from conspiranormal.podomatic.com or on the Fringe Radio Network and on IPBN Radio Network. So join us next week, or actually about 2 weeks from today. I'm going to have on R.J. von Bruni. We're going to talk about the key of the Book of Enoch. It's going to be a really interesting show. I'm really excited to dig into that material. And also in about 3 weeks from now, we're going to be having Nick Redfern back on. And we're going to talk to Nick about one of his latest books about conspiracies, and looks real interesting stuff. And also want to get to talk to him about the Roswell slides as well. So some great things coming up, guys. Just stay tuned. Great things on the way, as always. And thanks for listening to Conspiranormal.